this wall with me, go where I go, share all the dreams with me, I need you so.
Hello and welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights radio show. I'm your host, Sandra Kyle, and today we'll be taking a few steps with Stephen James Brassett, who's hitting the road on a year-long charity walk to raise awareness about animals in shelters and sanctuaries, the people who look after them, and how we can support them. Animal shelters and sanctuaries are in every community, and many of them are struggling, not only financially, but also in terms of voluntary help. The funds from Stephen's walk will go to them. Back in early January, Stephen and his two companion animals, Pugalia Jake and Chihuahua Cross Piccolo, began their longest walk ever, a journey that would take them zigging and zagging across the country, from Invercargill to the far north. Stephen is not just walking, he's towing a 100kg trailer, which he sleeps in with the two dogs. The modified bike camper can hold enough food for 10 days, enough dog food for 20 days, and 11 litres of water. It's a well-planned and executed journey, and he blogs about it as he goes. I caught up when he was just north of Taupo. Hi, Stephen. I hope you're not too tired or cold. How are Jake and Piccolo?
Yeah, good, thanks. Setting up camp for the day and drying off Jake, because it's a little bit wet today, but he'll be right.
Tell us how you're getting around. You've got some kind of a modified camper. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. So I based the camper on a bike camper which a man named Paul Elkins designed. Mm-hmm. And I turned it into more of a rickshaw type of thing. So it's something that I pull behind me as I'm walking. It's about as long as me and about a metre and a half wide. And yeah, it's just got everything in there that I need.
And how heavy is it to pull?
It weighs about 100 kilos, but the way that it's leveraged and loaded sort of makes it feel about 15, 20 kilos on the shoulder.
Right, goodness me. And what about going up and down hills?
Yeah, that's a different story. It feels like 100 kilos then.
Oh, golly.
That's not too bad. It's all good.
Right. Okay, so please tell us how the longest walk began to take shape in your mind. I've read that when you were working in a shelter in Melbourne, you became disillusioned. Is that when we had the genesis of the longest walk?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say disillusioned, but I basically got quite burnt out. Like, compassion fatigue is what it's officially called.
Mm.
And I was working as a dog handler, and that role, it was just the same thing all the time. It was always having the same conversations and feeling like I was the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, basically. And I felt very reactive, and I wanted to do something more proactive. So I thought, looked through a few different things, different ways I might do that. But in the end, I decided on this, which gives me the power to do what I want to do and to meet lots of different people and get a real good feel for what's going on in animal welfare in New Zealand as well.
Hmm. And when did you actually begin and when did you start planning it?
Well, the actual walk started on January the 7th this year, and that was from Invercargill at the Southland SPCA. I couldn't tell you exactly when planning started, but it would have been a good 6 months of properly nailing things down. It took me a couple of months to build the camper and a few more months before that, sort of working out how I was going to go about it, trying to rustle up some sponsors, as well as writing a book about what it was about.
Yes, that's a very good e-book, and I'll make that available on our Facebook page as well. So has it gone relatively smoothly? I've heard that you had a crash at one point.
Oh yeah, life happens, but overall it's been pretty good and people have been really supportive and making it happen too.
Mm. And when you're retiring for the night, you and Jake and Piccolo, you all get into your camper, you pull off the side of the road or go into a paddock or what?
Well, I try and abide by local laws, so I find a place which is going to be suitable. So basically what I do is I work out roughly how far I want to go in the day, and then when I get there I work out what the situation is. Sometimes people will offer up a yard or a garage or a shed or something like that. Other times I might find a campground nearby. Other times it might be just whatever, really. A lot of the time it's been going to schools as well and doing talks for schools.
Brilliant.
In the morning, sort of in exchange for parking up at their place overnight.
Right. You state on your website that you've basically got four goals. I'll just read them out. Reduce the strain on domestic animal welfare systems, empower people to help domestic animal welfare organisations, educate people about animal needs and effective communication, and to keep families together and improve welfare of animals and their humans. So they're very wide-ranging goals. Do you want to talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, all right. Basically, what I'm planning to do is let people know what's around in their area so that they can make an informed decision about where they might like to put their energies. Because really what I want to do is encourage people to get involved with the organisations, I suppose, in a more proactive way. It's great giving donations and all that sort of stuff, and that stuff is really important to keep the shelters going. But what really needs to happen is they need more hands to do the work, and they also need more regular donations, so people who might be able to rig something through a business, or they might like to do things like running fundraisers and really starting to up the ante a little bit, because most of the organisations are scraping together the money as it comes, and you know, they can all use help. I really just want to introduce people to what's there and encourage them to get involved, really, and those goals will be achieved through them being more effective at what they're already doing.
Right. You're talking about shelters like SPCA and other shelters, but also sanctuaries, is that right?
I'm deliberately leaving it quite open. I didn't want to narrow it down too much,
right?
But I did have to make a call as to what I was going to focus on. So I decided to focus on domestic organisations as opposed to wildlife and that sort of thing, or farm animals. Although there's some crossover there, and I'm happy to work with anyone who may want some help in getting their profile raised. Yeah, and as far as sanctuaries and shelters, it's really anything. So I've spoken to a few authors about books they've done about welfare-related things, or people who are running interesting initiatives to do with fundraising or something like that. But mostly, I'm planning to visit all of the SPCAs through the country, and they form the main skeleton of the route.
Yeah.
And from those centres, I try and find whatever I can there. So there's lots of rescues and small shelters, things like that.
You mentioned that you were working as a dog trainer. What have you learned about dog psychology?
I've learned that a lot of dogs' problems, or animals in general, a lot of their lifestyle problems stem from us. And really what we have to do is we have to be more aware of what we're doing in order to give dogs and other animals a fair go.
Can you give an example of that?
Oh, I can give you millions. Basically, any problems we have with our animals, it comes down to a mismatch of expectations more than an actual behavioural problem most of the time. Every now and then there's a behavioural thing, which could be a biochemical type thing, or there might be something actually physically wrong with the dog. But generally, behaviours they're displaying are either inadvertently encouraged by us, or they're perfectly natural behaviours which we should expect from animals. And they just don't gel with what we might like to expect in a human family.
I'm just thinking now of certain breeds of dogs where they're more likely to attack. And, of course, those breeds have to be restrained in some way when they're out and about and so on. But dogs are like human beings. You get different types of personalities, for the want of a better word. Should everyone who owns a dog go to obedience school and have the dog trained?
They certainly should, regardless of the breed. Breed is a very contentious issue, and New Zealand is one of the few places which still has a breed-specific legislation in place.
Right.
There's a few assumptions out there that the breed is going to make a big difference. It does, in the fact that the larger dogs are obviously more powerful. Any aggression or problems there are going to be amplified by the size of the dog. But there's no excuse for people with smaller dogs. Like, I have two smaller dogs, and they've both had a lot of training because I want to be able to communicate my expectations for a number of reasons. One, it's for the safety of others. I don't really want my dogs biting others, for example. But also it's to do with communication and giving that dog a fair go, giving them an idea of what you actually mean. The thing that often gets lost is people logically understand that animals don't understand human language, but the way that we behave is completely different. So we'll often talk to animals and tell them what we want them to do without actually showing them what those words mean.
Consistency is really important, isn't it, when you have any animals, but perhaps particularly dogs?
Only particularly dogs, because they live in the household with us, same with cats. Consistency and just clarity. There's a couple of notes on that in that ebook that they can download.
Yeah.
Bottom line, for me, it comes down to if you've got someone in your family, you want them to understand the rules. The only way you can do that is by learning about how to clearly communicate. That's what dog training is, or animal training.
But dogs can be more aggressive if they're not happy. Is that right? I mean, you say that dogs live inside with us, but I know many dogs who are never allowed inside the house and who are outside in all weathers and just stay there while their family are away the whole day, may or may not be walked. Some of those dogs that I know of lead their lives on a chain. Now, that would make any dog unhappy and aggressive, would it not?
I'm not sure of any connection between aggression and unhappiness, but certainly when they're not included in the life of their family, what they essentially see as their family, then they become very lonely. It can be damaging to their mental health in a number of ways.
Course, yes.
I'm not sure if that necessarily has been shown to lead to aggression, but certainly it does do a few things. So a dog on a chain, for example, what they can find is they learn things that we may not intend for them to learn, and we may believe things about them which aren't necessarily true. And I'll give you one example to do with aggression. If a dog is on a chain in their yard and they are frightened of someone approaching the front fence, for example, someone walks up and they get a fright. What do? They bark. From their point of view, they see this person walk across the fence line from their entry into their point of view and then out of their point of view as they're barking. From the dog's point of view, they have barked and that caused the person to go away. The reality is the person was probably going to walk past regardless, but the way that the dog sees it is, I was scared, this person came, I barked, they went away because I barked. So he then learns, right, next time if I bark, this person's going to go away. So what we set this dog up to do is learn a pattern of, when I get scared, I bark what humans say is aggressive, and then the problem goes away. So what we do end up doing is, by setting up the environment that way, we teach the dog coping mechanisms which are aggressive. Does that make sense?
It's opulent conditioning, isn't it?
It is. It's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's conditioning. So those sorts of things are things we don't necessarily mean to do. And the way we read it is different too. So a lot of people consider these dog guard dogs, for example. Now, there's a very big difference between a trained attack dog and what most people consider as guard dogs, because their state of mind is completely different. Opposite, in fact. A trained attack dog is very confident and assertive, and he enjoys the behaviour that he's doing because he's trained to have success in what he's been doing, and he knows what he's doing. He's in a good state of mind. A dog like what I've just described on a chain, for example, they're in a terrible state of mind. Yeah. They're incredibly fearful. There's no confidence there. All they know is they want this thing to go away. The build-up of stress in that dog is similar to in a human. When you're in a constantly stressed environment, it has a physical effect on your body and puts you in poor health. So those things as well. And then obviously, unfortunately, a lot of the dogs that are on a chain wouldn't be looked after in quite the way that they really need to as well, as far as food, water, attention.
Exactly. I once knew someone whose job was to put dogs to sleep. She worked in an animal shelter. She told me how heartbreaking it was to take the dog out of its cage, and he or she thinking that maybe they were going to a nice home or going out for a walk or something and looking forward to it, and their eyes bright and their tail wagging expectantly. And then she had to take them into a room and give them an injection. She eventually left. She said she couldn't stand it anymore. It's a very sad scenario, and it's repeated all over the world. And here in New Zealand, depending on the shelter, sometimes multiple times every single day. It's a very harsh reality. Do you have any ideas to share with us about how we can begin to address this?
Yeah, I've got loads. Part of the reason I'm doing this is, again, the welfare organisations are there to, ultimately, anyone who's working there, they want to give animals a better deal. That's why they're there. That's why they started that job in the first place. And the more effective we can help them be, the more likely we are to see that happen. So by giving them support, by giving them donations, by giving them your volunteer time, by helping by fostering, by creating other outlets such as other rescues, places where they have other options, because the reality is when animals end up in a shelter, they've either got to be adopted out or sent to another rescue organisation to be adopted out by them, or they're put to sleep. There's only really two ways that it ends.
Do you know of
any? Or return to the owner, one way or another.
Do you know of any shelters in New Zealand who have a no-kill policy?
I know that no-kill is a funny thing, because people sometimes think that no-kill actually means what it says, which is that they don't kill. And I doubt there's ever going to be any shelters in the whole world that actually have that policy. There are a lot of shelters moving towards a much lower kill, and what that means is that they will only put to sleep animals which are either suffering or things like that. So bottom line is they're not putting animals to sleep because they don't
have space,
for example. Most of the shelters in the country are moving that way. I don't think it's necessarily something that any of them can just snap their fingers and change straight away. There are limitations on a number of different things, and as I say, one of the main things is how many outlets are there and how many other options are there.
The companion animal problem is quite wide-reaching, isn't it? Because cats especially, but dogs also, roaming in native bush can do damage to birds and other species and impact fragile biosystems and so on. It doesn't exist in isolation. What is the companion animal problem in New Zealand, and how can it be improved?
Well, basically, all of an animal's problems and all of our problems with animals as society comes down to the fact that we are creating quite an artificial situation, really. And the bottom line is, if people do decide to take on a companion animal, that they have to accept the responsibility of conforming to the needs of a society. What that means is desexing. A lot of people have problems with desexing, saying that it's not natural or, you know, those sorts of things. The reality is we have created an environment which is not natural for them to be in, and we have created this imbalance. Right or wrong, desexing is one of the only ways that we're going to keep that under control. The other thing is we need to be aware of where animals are. We can't allow them to just roam freely, and it doesn't make any difference if you're in an urban environment or if you're on a farm. They shouldn't be able to just roam to all areas. That's your responsibility as a pet owner.
Yeah.
So that might mean building enclosures, it might mean making sure you've got adequate fencing, it might mean making sure that you're not just letting dogs run free through the forest, all those sorts of things. It's about knowing where your animals are and keeping them safe, because the reality is, with the society we're in, the consequences can be disastrous for the animal if you allow them to get themselves in trouble.
There's a checklist, isn't there, for any potential new owner. Can you just rattle off some of the points that people need to consider before they think of getting a companion animal?
My checklist isn't in any way exhaustive. Other organisations are all going to have their own checklist. I'm sure they have their reasons for choosing the things they've chosen. But the main thing for me personally is you've got to be realistic with yourself about what you want in an animal in your house, and making sure that you can provide those things. So some big ones are exercise requirements, and that's not just a breed thing, although breed definitely plays a very important part in that. Personality is very important in that as well. People may also be surprised that often the smaller dogs are some of the ones that need a lot of exercise, whereas some larger breeds can actually be quite lazy. Do you have the money to pay for food, vet care, preventative vet care as well? So that's things like worming and flea treatments, vaccinations, things like that. Or an alternative if you prefer not to vaccinate, things like that. Can you manage that animal? Sometimes people's intentions don't necessarily match up with their skill set. Taking on a previously feral cat, for example, is going to take a lot of work and a lot of attention, as is taking on a puppy of any breed. Can you spare the time for training? Realistically, spend the time that you need to with the animal. Are you better off getting a cat if you're less able to spend time as opposed to a dog? So there's that sort of thing. Other things you've got to think about are containment. So like we were talking about before, it's a requirement, both legally and socially, that you are able to keep track of where your animal is, making sure you're keeping them safe. Bottom line, really, you're taking on another member of your family, so it's a lot of the same things that you might think about when you're having a child. Some people will scoff at that, probably not the listeners of your show, because I imagine there's a lot of people who would agree, probably preaching to the converted.
It's not just the converted who listen.
Okay. Yep. As I say, it really is a big decision. It's like taking on an adopted child. And if you're not willing to think of it that way, then perhaps you should think about not adopting. And the other thing is, I would encourage adopting over buying. Unfortunately, there are a number of animals who are surplus to requirement, if you like. There are far more who are already looking for homes, so I don't personally support even particular breed
Right. You don't recommend that people buy from breeders and not from pet shops?
There are some pet shops which now act as adoption centres for, like, the SPCA.
Right.
For example,
right.
I know that Animates acts as an adoption centre for shelters.
Mm.
So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but certainly you wouldn't want to be buying from pet shops, I don't think.
I read that there are some problems with illegal dogfighting rings, and they use very small dogs as live bait. Could that be true in New Zealand?
Unfortunately, it is. I don't think it's as big a problem as it is in some other countries. But people do need to be aware that it happens. People steal dogs from yards. People also use free to a good home ads as a way to source dogs for lots of things, but that is one of the things. So people have to be really aware of who, if they are choosing to rehome, for example, who they're rehoming to. A good way to do that is using a reputable rescue or a reputable shelter. They can help. Even if they can't take your animal on board because of resources, then they can at least help you insofar as pointing you in the right direction. At the very least, if people do want to do something like adopting using Facebook ads or Trade Me ads, you should always have some sort of fee, even if you use that fee to put it forward as a donation to a local shelter.
Uh-huh.
The reason being that if you're going to put a fee on the adoption, it makes people take it more seriously, and it's something they're going to consider more. It's also something less likely to feed into something like dogfighting rings.
How many places have you visited so far? You've been on the road 6 months, right?
Yeah, just over. Couldn't tell you exactly, but it must be over half the SPCAs, of which there are 46, probably at least as many rescues and other shelters as well. So I think I'm probably looking at around about 20 SPCAs or just over, and probably more like about 30 to 40 rescues and shelters, I suppose. It's been a busy old 6 months.
It's been a busy old 6 months, and a very tiring one. You must have coped with cold and pain and muscle fatigue and so on, all in a very good cause. And how are your dogs getting on? Are they loving it?
I mean, the three of us are pretty active types anyway. Like, people want to paint it as a big
Sacrifice,
something like that. But for me, honestly, I enjoy having an active lifestyle, so if I wasn't walking with the camper, I'd be doing something to use my body anyway. It's had challenges, but everyone has their challenges in their life. We're walking along, and I'm constantly keeping an eye on my own body as well as the dogs.
If the dogs get tired, they just go into the camper,
so as I say, I'm keeping an eye on them all the time.
Yes.
And Piccolo most of the time isn't walking with us. Most of the time Piccolo's in the camper. he's usually sleeping.
Right.
And Jake, on the other hand, is very active, enthusiastic, and he wants to be out, so he tends to be out all the time.
Right.
Except for when it's dangerous or when it's really wet, cold, things like that.
Now, where can people look out for you? You're just north of Taupo at the moment. When will you be in Auckland, for example?
Couldn't give you an exact time, but it's going to be probably at least a month, I'd say.
Right.
Rough estimate.
You're coming through Hamilton?
On the way back down, I'll be going through Hamilton.
On the way down.
I'm going up from the bottom of Lake Taupo, so Tūrangi. I'm going to be going up the western road around there through Tokoroa and then up to the Coromandel and through Auckland and up through Northland. And then from Whangarei, that's the northernmost SPCA, I'll be turning around and heading back down the other side, so heading down the western route towards Wellington, where I'll finish up.
And you'd like people to donate, and there'll be a PayPal or Give a Little on your website, and money that is collected will be distributed amongst the shelters. Is that right?
Yep. So if people do want to donate, then they can. The instructions on the website there.
Yeah.
So if they go to the longest walk NZ, that'll tell you how to donate. And I've deliberately separated it into two streams so they know where their money's going. So if they do want to support the charities directly, they can either directly donate to the charities, or they can donate to the Give a Little. And if they want to support me as far as helping me along the way, then they can do that through PayPal.
Oh, it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
The Longest Walk NZ. If they search for The Longest Walk NZ,
it'll come up.
Top four will be me.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant, Stephen. I'm so glad we've had good reception. And it's good to know that you're in good health and in good spirits. So you've done 6 months and you've got approximately another 6 months to go.
Yeah, is that right?
You've got a blog, so people can follow the various stages of your journey on the blog.
They can, yep.
And just quickly before we go, what's your plan for next year? I'm not sure I want you to answer that.
I deliberately haven't made a plan yet. Part of the philosophy behind doing this walk is putting my intentions into things which are important to me with the belief that it will lead on to something else one way or another, whether it be self-directed or any opportunities that may come up along the way.
Well, I personally will be watching, and thank you again. Go well, and give a hug to Jake and Piccolo from me.
Okay, I shall do that shortly.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Stephen. Okay. Bye-bye now.
See ya. Bye.
Walk through this world with me. Go where I go.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. It's an admirable outreach that Stephen is engaged in. I'll put all the links up on our Facebook page, Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. But if you Google The Longest Walk in Z, it will all come up for you, including a very informative ebook that you can download for free. There's a Give a Little account and a PayPal account on the website as well. You can watch Stephen's progress online and read his blogs. And if he's passing your way, go and say hi. We'll go out on a track that is very appropriate for today's theme, and I dedicate it to all the wonderful people who work in shelters and in sanctuaries. And I'd also like to dedicate it to Stephen himself, and of course to Jake and Piccolo, and to every companion animal who we love and share our lives with. Thanks for tuning in to Safe and Sound. Tune in again next week. Until then, go well. Bye-bye.
When I wake up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I haver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's havering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more to be the man who walked 1,000 miles to fall down at your door.
When I'm working, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. When the money comes in for the work I do, I'll pass almost every penny on to you.